So let's go ahead and go into the sermon today. Trying to figure out what to title it. The title that I started with, and I may keep it or I may not, is called Perilous Times. I did a series on the King of the North and the King of the South a while back. You may remember that, where we went through prophecies that dealt with what was going on in the Middle East, in the Arabic world, what was happening in Europe, and how those would end up playing out in the end time. I hadn't intended to readdress that topic again for quite a while, but sometimes things happen in the news that are very noteworthy, and sometimes they're not worthy of a sermon, but occasionally something happens where we in the church would look at that and say, there's some significance here. There actually were two things that happened in this couple of weeks while I was convalescing. You know, students of the Bible will often pick out world events as worthy of paying attention to. And I would just say this after hearing this sermon, if you want to go back and listen to the ones on King of the North and the King of the South, they're on the New Orleans website. It might be good to go back and review those in light of what we'll be talking about today. But anyway, there were two recent events that struck me, and my initial intent was to give a sermon on both of those topics today, and they're too big to be able to handle in one. One of them was on the UN Resolution 2334 against Israel. I know a lot of you have seen that. And then the second was the assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey. I'm going to talk about the first one today, about the UN resolution against Israel. But I would like for you to consider in your own personal study, CNN had a very interesting article on this Russian ambassador, and they did a kind of a side-by-side comparison. On December 23rd or whatever it was, so-and-so pulled a gun out and shot the Turkish ambassador. And then right beside it was, on December 19th or whatever, 1914, so-and-so shot Archduke Ferdinand, and a month later it started World War I. Events like that, we know that a lot of things are happening in the world that eventually will cause the trigger to get pulled. And so I was going to talk about the assassination of the Russian ambassador and compare it to 1914. That may be a study that you can do on your own. But this UN resolution against Israel is one that I wanted to spend virtually the entire sermon on today and talk about what implications that might have. So UN Resolution 2334 was called by, on December the 23rd of this year. There were 14 votes for it, 0 votes against it, and 1 abstention, notably the United States. As a result of that, there was an agreement among the UN that Israel had to cease all of their settlement activities. And I'll talk more about that if you haven't been paying attention to it. Their settlement activities in Palestinian-occupied territory. They were being told that they needed to dismantle all of the settlements that they've made since March of 2001, and that they had to comply with the 1967 boundaries in support of a two-state solution. Now, I'm actually going to show a video in a little while that will help explain that a little bit more. But what's at issue? First of all, I want to take the first part of this sermon and just talk about what is at issue here and some promises that God gave to Israel in the Old Testament. You know, both Israel and Palestine are fighting to be recognized as a sovereign nation. Palestine wants to be, they want their own flag, their own territory, their own laws, their own army, their own police force, and they want to be a nation. Israel wants to be recognized by everyone as a sovereign nation, and they want their own territory, their own army. The problem is both of these peoples want their separate nation in the same territory at the same time, and it's not going to work. You can't have two countries that want the same piece of land. I know when you look at this from both sides, there are a lot of videos out there. I saw one from Dennis Prager. Some of you may have seen that was very pro-Israel. Here's why Israel should have this land. There are others out there that I've seen that are more from the Palestinian point of view. Here's why the Palestinians should have this land and Israel needs to get out. I'm going to show one in a little while that tries to go down the middle of that and show both sides of this. We'll see how that turns out, but at least it'll give you an idea of what's going on. So what's this two-state solution that they're talking about? both Israel and Palestine are wanting to get to the place where everybody recognizes them as independent nations. There is a what ultimately the UN is hoping for is that there will be a nation called Israel and a nation called Palestine, all kind of jumbled together in the same area. And you'll see some maps on that in a little bit. There also was a solution that was offered at one time called a one-state solution, where Israel and Palestine would form one nation. And right now, what's the Israeli governing bodies, the Knesset, etc., they would have Palestinian representatives on that, and that they would all be in the same governing bodies trying to jointly rule. If you know anything about the contention between these two people, that's a lot like putting two wild dogs in a room together and saying, please get along, I'll be back in a couple of years. It's just not going to work. So most people would say that the best solution, and the UN would say this, I don't think the church does, I'm just telling you what worldview is that a two-state solution is going to be the best one, where we try somehow and come up with two sovereign nations that have their own territory, rule of law, and military. The problem is, and this will sound very potentially political on my part, but I guess it's how I see it. The problem is the Palestinians and most of the Arab world refuse to acknowledge Israel as a sovereign nation. There's a reason for that. We're going to get into some of the biblical stories and prophecies about how the surrounding nations see Israel. Israel, on the other hand, has agreed to accept the two-state solution, but only if the Palestinians would recognize them as a sovereign nation. So Israel has gone to the UN and said, if the Palestinians will accept us as a legitimate nation, we will accept them as a legitimate nation and we'll have a two-state solution. Palestinians have said no. Israel needs to be wiped off the map. So far we have had an impasse. Into this mix, Israel, and you'll see that in just a moment, has had so many surrounding nations that have been against them that they are trying to hedge themselves in to do the best that they can to defend their property. And as a result, they have expanded into territory that is considered by most of the world as Palestinian territory by building settlements. So what do you do? We're trying to build a wall between us and Mexico. Other places have built walls like that. There is an existing wall in Israel that has been built to try and put the Palestinians on one side and the Israelis on the other. But even at that, Israel is paying to have settlers move into areas that are considered Palestinian-occupied territory. And they're doing that because they believe Israel is doing that because they believe that that will help protect their national interest. Now, since most of the rest of the world seems to be against them, then Israel seems to be the bad guy. So every time Israel tries to protect its self-interest, the rest of the world seems to be against them. One of the interesting things, and I think sad things, is the one nation that always had Israel's back was the United States, up until the current administration, which did not feel and did not support or not back the nation of Israel. Israel has demonstrated in the past that they would be willing to abandon these settlements and return to their sides if the Palestinians would recognize their right to exist. And they actually did that at one time. You'll see it in this movie clip. They took over the Sinai Peninsula and started building settlements in there. And then they had an agreement with Nasser of Egypt. And as a result of that, they dismantled their settlements. They got out of the conflicted area and gave it back to Egypt. They did the same thing in Gaza. If you'll remember, they had settlements in Gaza. And when they reached an agreement with the Palestinians in that area, they actually tore them down and got out of there. The settlements they see as a way of hedging them in. And if they believe there's peace, they will pull out. But the truth is, both sides believe that they are fighting for their very survival. Now, how did this happen in the first place? What I want to do is take just a little bit of time, and I want to read some of the history going all the way back to the time after Abraham, to give you an idea of the conflict in this area. We look at this country as, you know, 200 years ago is a long, long time. But in the minds of people in the Middle East, a long, long time is 5,000 years. 200 years is nothing. That's a drop in the bucket. Some of this goes way back. So let's turn to Exodus chapter 23, and I want to start here. Exodus chapter 23, and I'll start in verse 31. There are several other scriptures that I could go to even before this, but I'll start with this one. At the end of this sermon, you're going to think that I haven't summarized anything, but I assure you, I have summarized a lot. There's so much that I could have gotten into here. Verse 31 of Exodus chapter 23. This is God's promise to Moses as they were leaving Egypt, were heading toward the promised land. Here's what God told them. God said to Israel, I will set your bounds, and then here are the boundaries, from the Red Sea to the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, from Philistia, from the deserts to the river, and I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hands. Who are those inhabitants? Canaanites, Philistines, people from Ammon, Moab, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon. This is the people that we're talking about, the people that are currently involved in a lot of this fighting. I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. Verse 32, you will make no covenant with them nor with their gods. Now, I want you to consider that when you think about Israel trying to appease the UN by agreeing to allow the Palestinians to have a section of land and call it a nation. There are some people in the Knesset and in the Israeli government that are very religious that look at this and said, verse 32 says, don't make an agreement with them. So there are some people that are totally against trying to come up with a two-state solution because they feel that that land belongs to them. It was given to them by God. No one else has a right. We were supposed to have displaced them, and so we shouldn't be coming up with a solution. Verse 33, they will not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So this promise to Israel was their, and is today, this belief that this is their land, period. And anybody else that's in it is trespassing. Now, a lot of those people and a lot of the background of those people were there prior to Israel showing up and Israel displaced them. Interestingly enough, if you read who those people are, some of them, not all, but some of them are actually descendants from Abraham themselves. They're relatives of the Israelites. Ammon, Moab, those were descended from Lot, who was related to Abraham. Some of them, like the Philistines in the Palestinian area of Gaza and others, don't trace themselves necessarily back to Abraham. They were in the land when Abraham showed up. But you look at some of these people in Syria, in Lebanon, in the modern nation of Jordan, some of those are actually related to the Israelites through Abraham. So anyway, this promise in Exodus 23 was originally given to Abraham, which would also seemingly cover Ishmael as well as Isaac. But then later on to Isaac and then to Jacob and then through Moses, God said, you know what? The promises for this land, even though they were Abrahamic promises, I am putting those through the people of Israel. Israel is the one that gets this land, not Ammon, not Moab, not Egypt. This land belongs to Israel, and the Israelis see that now. Turn to Joshua chapter 21, and we'll read a little bit more about what happened. Joshua chapter 21, and I want to start in verse 43. Joshua 21, verse 43 through 45. So the Eternal gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers. They took possession of it. They dwelt in it. Verse 44, the Eternal gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and not a man of all their enemies stood against them. Now why? Why was Israel at this point able to keep all of their enemies at bay? Notice what it said. The Eternal delivered all their enemies into their hands. Back during the days when they allowed God to fight their battles, they won. But what happened later on, we'll kind of talk about that a little bit tangentially, but they wanted a king. They wanted not to rely on God. They wanted a champion, and the champion was Saul. When they got to the place where they started to feel like they needed to protect their own national interest and their own borders, think about what they're doing today. They're trying to set up settlements to hedge their borders. When they're relying on themselves, then their enemies will start to push against them. For the Lord delivered all of their enemies into their hand. Verse 45, not a word failed of any good thing which the Eternal had spoken to the house of Israel. It all came to pass. When God was in charge, he gave them that land, and a lot of the people that were in the land were being pushed out. Now, as we know, everything went well for a while, but at some point in time, both the 10 tribes of Israel and the tribes of Judah and Benjamin and Levi were displaced from their national lands, and they had to leave. Let's go to Judges chapter 1. This is forward and right into the next book, just a few chapters in the future. Judges chapter 1. I want you to notice what happened. If you've got a Thomas Nelson Bible, the title over this section says, there was an incomplete conquest of the land. What was Israel supposed to do? They were supposed to go in. They were supposed to divide the land up. They were supposed to kick all of the inhabitants that were there out. How did it go? God, when they were letting God look after their national interest, God was protecting them. But what happened later on? This is now during the reigns of some of the judges and some of the leaders of the time that came through. We're going to start in verse 27 of Judges 1. And I'm going to read this whole section through just so you can get an idea. You can talk about all the 12 tribes of Israel. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. For the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. And it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but they didn't completely drive them out. They allowed the people that God said, don't let them stay. They let them stay. They started to make agreements. They started to make covenants with them. You're going to find that that's going to end up biting them later on. Verse 29, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. And the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. You know, there were certain cities. You have to kind of think about what it would have been like back then where they had city-states, if you know what I'm talking about. A city would get built. They'd put these big walls up around it. There would usually be one leader. They'd sometimes call it a king. A melech is the Hebrew word for it. I've got a sermon I'm preparing on that word, too. So this melech or this king would be over this particular place. Well, they would come in. The Israelites would come in, and some of them they were able to defeat pretty easy. You think about the walls of Jericho because they did what God said, and God called the walls to collapse. But later on, they said, well, you know what? God didn't tell us to go up to this city, but let's go take this one. And it didn't happen so well. And they didn't follow what God said. So there were all these little city-states that were allowed to remain. Verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Naalal. And the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. What happens when somebody puts you under tribute? It's called slavery. There's another way of saying that. Not only did this used to be our land, and not only did you try and displace us, but you're stronger than us, and you've put us under tribute. Now we've got to pay taxes to you. We got to do your dirty work. Israel would take people from these lands and say, well, we'll let them stay, but they'll be our servants. They'll clean our house. They'll dig our wells. They'll, you know, hoe our gardens. Okay, so how's that go? How do you think the Canaanites felt about that? You can start to see this conflict start to build. 31, nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Echo or the inhabitants of Sidon, or, and they just list a whole laundry list there that I can't pronounce. Verse 32, so the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Verse 33, Naphtali talks about that. We already read that. Verse 34, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. The Amorites were another Canaanite race that was in there, and they did not allow them to come to the valley, for the Ammonites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres and several other places. And when the strength of Joseph became great, what do? They kick him out? No, they put them under tribute. All that does is just make people mad, right? If you're going to put them under slavery. Verse 36, the boundary of the Ammonites was from the ascent of Akrabim from Selah and upward. So as we look through this, they didn't do what God told them to do. God told them two things. Let me do it, and then what I tell you to do, go do, and you'll get rid of all the people in this land, and you'll have it, and you'll have it peacefully. Israel did not do what God said, and that conflict has been waging ever since. You can read in the Bible about wars with the Philistines. That's in Gaza. You'll see it, you'll see a map in a little while. If you don't know where the Gaza Strip is, you'll see that. The Palestinians today, a lot of them stem from the Philistines. And so you'll see this area. That was the Philistines. You think of David fighting Goliath and all of those stories. That's this area today called Gaza. You also can read in the Bible about the nations of Ammon and Moab. That's modern-day Jordan fighting against Israel. You can read about Syria and Lebanon and Egypt fighting against Israel. And then finally, Assyria and Babylonian empires ended up defeating Israel and Judah and displacing them. So those are the stories in the Bible. You can read, just again, hundreds of stories. You could take hours and hours and hours and just read about the conflicts in the Middle East between Israel and the surrounding Canaanites that were in the land. But the Bible was completed already. What we have canonized was done. What's happened since the time of the Bible? And that's what we want to spend some more time talking about today. How has it looked in the past 1,000 years or even in the past 100 years? Have those problems continued to go? Now, I want to play a video here so you guys back there can get it ready. This is a 10-minute video. I purposely tried to find one that was somewhere down the middle. If you are on the Israeli side, you'll say this is a pro-Palestinian film. If you're on the Palestinian side, you'll say this is a pro-Israeli film. But it's a guy that sat down and he tried to explain in as neutral terms as he could why there's conflict in the Middle East. What I find interesting, he doesn't talk about it, but I want you to look at the pictures that they show in the background. They're not just maps. He'll show pictures of Abraham sacrificing Isaac. He's going to have biblical stories that are in the background that he never references. But you can tell that whoever put this together recognized that these problems go way back. But what he's trying to do is say, even though the problems go way back, let's just talk about what happened since 1917 or whatever, and he focuses more on this. But I think this will give you an idea of the conflicts that are happening in the Middle East. So what I want to do now is watch a 10-minute video, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more about this.
One of the biggest myths about the Israel-Palestine conflict is that it's been going on for centuries, all about ancient religious hatreds. In fact, while religion is involved, conflict's mostly about two groups of people who claim the same land, and it really only goes back about a century to the early 1900s. Around then, the region along the eastern Mediterranean we now call Israel-Palestine, then under Ottoman rule for centuries, was religiously diverse, including mostly Muslims and Christians, also a small number of Jews who lived generally in peace. It was changing in two important ways. First, more people in the region were developing a sense of being not just ethnic Arabs, but Palestinians, a distinct national identity. At the same time, not so far away in Europe, more Jews were joining a movement called Zionism, which said that Judaism was not just a religion, but a nationality, one that deserved a nation of its own. And after centuries of persecution, many believed a Jewish state was their only way of safety and saw their historic homeland in the Middle East as their best hope for establishing it. In the first decades of the 20th century, tens of thousands of European Jews moved there. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire collapsed, and British and French empires carved up the Middle East, the British taking control of a region it called the British Mandate for Palestine. At first, the British allowed Jewish immigration. But as more Jews arrived, settling into farming communities, tension between Jews and Arabs grew. Both sides committed acts of violence, and by the 1930s, the British began limiting Jewish immigration. In response, Jewish militias formed to fight both the local Arabs and to resist British rule. Then came the Holocaust, leading many more Jews to flee Europe for British Palestine and galvanizing much of the world in support of a Jewish state. In 1947, as sectarian violence between Jews and Arabs there grew, the United Nations approved a plan to divide British Palestine into two separate states, one for Jews, Israel, and one for Arabs, Palestine. The city of Jerusalem, where Jews, Muslims, and Christians all have holy sites, was to become a special international zone. The plan was meant to give Jews a state, to establish Palestinian independence, and to end the sectarian violence that the British could no longer control. The Jews accepted the plan, and they declared independence as Israel. But Arabs throughout the region saw the UN plan as just more European colonialism trying to steal their land. Many of the Arab states, who had just recently won independence themselves, declared war on Israel in an effort to establish a unified Arab Palestine where all of British Palestine had been. The new state of Israel won the war, but in the process, they pushed well past their borders under the UN plan, taking the western half of Jerusalem and much of the land that was to have been part of Palestine. They also expelled huge numbers of Palestinians from their homes, creating a massive refugee population whose descendants today number about 7 million. At the end of the war, Israel controlled all of the territory except for Gaza, which Egypt controlled, and the West Bank, named because it's west of the Jordan River, which Jordan controlled. This was the beginning of the decades-long Arab-Israeli conflict. During this period, many Jews in Arab-majority countries fled or were expelled, arriving in Israel. Then something happened to transform the conflict. In 1967, Israel and the neighboring Arab states fought another war. When it ended, Israel had seized the Golan Heights from Syria, the West Bank from Jordan, and both Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. Israel was now occupying the Palestinian territories, including all of Jerusalem and its holy sites. This left Israel responsible for governing the Palestinians, a people it had fought for decades. In 1978, Israel and Egypt signed the U.S.-brokered Camp David Accords. Shortly after that, Israel gave Sinai back to Egypt as part of the peace treaty. At the time, this was hugely controversial in the Arab world. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was assassinated in part because of outrage against it. But it marked the beginning of the end of the wider Arab-Israeli conflict. Over the next few decades, the other Arab states gradually made peace with Israel, even if they never signed formal peace treaties. But Israel's military was still occupying the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Gaza, and this is when the conflict became an Israeli-Palestinian struggle. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, which had formed in the 1960s to seek a Palestinian state, fought against Israel, including through acts of terrorism. Initially, the PLO claimed all of what had been British Palestine, meaning it wanted to end the state of Israel entirely. Fighting between Israel and the PLO went on for years, even including a 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon to kick the group out of Beirut.
The stillness of the ceasefire in southern Lebanon was shattered today by the sound of guns, bombs, and planes.
Now, the PLO later said it would accept dividing the land between Israel and Palestine, but the conflict continued. As all of this was happening, something dramatic was changing in the Israel-occupied Palestinian territories. Israelis were moving in. These people are called settlers, and they made their homes in the West Bank and Gaza, whether Palestinians wanted them or not. Some moved for religious reasons, some because they want to claim the land for Israel, some just because the housing is cheap, often subsidized by the Israeli government. Some settlements are cities with thousands of people, others are small communities deep into the West Bank.
If you've always felt a deep yearning for Jerusalem, now is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, not only to stand within its gates, but also to build the home of your dreams there.
The settlers are followed by soldiers to guard them, and the growing settlements force Palestinians off of their land and divide communities. Short-term, they make the occupation much more painful for Palestinians. Long-term, by dividing up Palestinian land, they make it much more difficult for the Palestinians to ever have an independent state. Today, there are several hundred thousand settlers in occupied territory, even though the international community considers them illegal. By the late 1980s, Palestinian frustration exploded into the Intifada, which is the Arabic word for uprising. It began with mostly protests and boycotts, but soon became violent. Israel responded with heavy force. A couple hundred Israelis, over 1,000 Palestinians died in the First Intifada. Around the same time, a group of Palestinians in Gaza, considered the PLO too secular, too compromise-minded, created Hamas, a violent, extremist group dedicated to Israel's destruction. By the early 1990s, It's clear that Israelis and Palestinians have to make peace. The leaders from both sides signed the Oslo Accords. This is meant to be the big first step toward Israel maybe someday withdrawing from the Palestinian territories and allowing an independent Palestine. The Oslo Accords established the Palestinian Authority, allowing Palestinians a little bit of freedom to govern themselves in certain areas. Hardliners on both sides opposed the Oslo Accords. Members of Hamas launched suicide bombings to try to sabotage the process. The Israeli right protest peace talks with ralliers calling Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin a traitor and Nazi. Not long after Rabin signs the second round of Oslo Accords, the far-right Israeli shoots him to death in Tel Aviv. But this violence showed how extremists on both sides can use violence to derail peace, keep a permanent conflict going as they seek the other side's total destruction. That's a dynamic that's been around ever since. Negotiations meant to hammer out the final details on peace drag on for years, and a big Camp David summit in 2000 comes up empty. Palestinians come to believe peace isn't coming, rise up in a second intifada, this one much more violent than the first. By the time it wound down a few years later, about 1,000 Israelis and 3,200 Palestinians had died. But the second intifada really changes the conflict. Israelis become much more skeptical that Palestinians will ever accept peace or that it's even worth trying. Israeli politics shift right, the country builds walls and checkpoints to control Palestinians' movements. They're not really trying to solve the conflict anymore, just to manage it. The Palestinians are left feeling like negotiating didn't work and violence didn't work, and that they're stuck under an ever-growing occupation with no future as a people. That year, Israel withdraws from Gaza. Hamas gains power, but splits from the Palestinian Authority in a short civil war, dividing Gaza from the West Bank. Israel puts Gaza under a suffocating blockade, and unemployment rises to 40%. This is the state of the conflict as we know it today. It's relatively new, and it's unbearable for Palestinians. In the West Bank, more and more settlements are smothering Palestinians, often respond with protests and sometimes with violence, though most just want normal lives. In Gaza, Hamas and other violent groups have periodic wars with Israel. The fighting overwhelmingly kills Palestinians, including lots of civilians. In Israel itself, most people have become apathetic. For the most part, the occupation keeps the conflict relatively removed from their daily lives, with moments of brief but horrible violence. There's little political will for peace. No one really knows where the conflict goes from here. Maybe a third intifada, maybe the Palestinian Authority collapses. But everyone agrees that things as they are now can't last much longer. Israel's occupation of the Palestinians is too unstable to last, and that unless something dramatic changes, whatever comes next will be much worse.
So you notice it ended, whatever will come next will be much worse. It can't last. Where they are right now, the situation as it is on the ground right now is untenable. Now, did you notice some of the pictures of Abraham sacrificing Isaac and other things in the background? Everybody on both sides has that in their political coffers. The Israelis believe that Abraham sacrificed Isaac. Who do the Arabs believe that Abraham was supposed to sacrifice? Ishmael. In their story, it's Ishmael, not Isaac. And they've got a lot of the exact same stories. And they believe it, just like Israel believes it. Every time I see Oslo Accords or the Camp David Accords, I think of the scripture that says, don't make a covenant with them. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to solve this on their own. And it's not working. So, again, students of the Bible, we're going to get to some prophecies in just a little bit, know that there is a huge conflict that's coming in that area. I thought it was interesting that a couple of months before this current UN resolution, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the Prime Minister of Israel, went before the UN, flew to the United States, and spoke to the UN. And I'm going to quote something that he said here, which I think is very interesting. You know, the theory is that the UN is supposed to be a group of people that tries to help the world live at peace. He makes this comment. He says, year after year, this is Benjamin Netanyahu talking to them. Year after year, I've stood at this very podium and I have slammed the UN for its obsessive bias against Israel. The UN deserves every scathing word for the disgrace of the General Assembly. In the last year alone, you have passed 20 resolutions against the Democratic State of Israel and a grand total of three resolutions against the rest of the world. Israel, 20. Rest of the world, 3. So a lot of what the UN is for, what it's become, is to try and defeat, as it were, this whole idea of Israel expanding. Now, it's under the auspices of trying to get this two-state system going. But again, if you think about what I said earlier and even what he said in here, the Palestinians will not ever accept nation of Israel. And because they won't, there will never be a two-state solution. I wouldn't accept it. I'll accept you as a nation, even though you don't accept me as a nation. That's foolishness. But again, they're trying to do it on their own. On December 28th, if you saw it just a couple of days ago, John Kerry stood up and made his own pronouncements. And he told people in his speech that the two-state solution was the only path to peace and that the further widening gap between Israel and the Palestinians would not get fixed unless Israel stopped doing what they're doing. There's nothing in there about, oh, by the way, Palestinians, you quit bombing people. There's nothing there. So the incoming administration, and I think this is what we need to kind of be watching for 2017, the incoming administration with Donald Trump has a very different opinion of things than the outgoing administration of Barack Obama. So how will that relate to what is happening in the Middle East? I don't know, but we'll talk about some of that. Benjamin Netanyahu gave a reaction to Senator Kerry's speech, and I'm quoting him now. He said, "For over an hour, Mr. Kerry obsessively dealt with settlements as the problem, but barely touched upon the root of the conflict. The Palestinians will not in any way accept a Jewish state." So again, from the Israeli perspective, if they would just say, you have a right to exist. If you think about all of the countries that surround them, Iran has said for years that it's their goal to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Hamas has said that. The PLO has said that. Where is this leading? And why would Phil Sandilands think this was worthy of a sermon? What I want to do today is I want to spend the rest of the time that we have here to talk about prophecies of the Bible about this section of the world. And think, hopefully, as we go through this, we can understand it a little better. I'd like to start in 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And we're going to read about perilous times. I actually want to read this from the Living Bible. That's not something that I ever recommend. You're probably surprised that I'm even saying this. It's not a very good paraphrase. But this one little section here, I thought that they made some interesting points, and I thought it would be worth reading this. Starting in verse 2, this is how the Living Bible says. This is Paul talking to Timothy. He says, "Timothy, you may well know that in the last days, it's going to be very difficult on Christians." And I think that's going to be important for us to understand as the world continues in conflict. The church is going to have its toughness in this too. There's going to be some problems that even we will have to face. Verse 2, "People will love only themselves and their money. They will be proud and boastful." Again, I'm reading from the Living Bible. "They will sneer at God." When you look at what's happening in the world today, do you see people, especially in this country, sneering at God? "They will be disobedient to their parents. They will be ungrateful to them and thoroughly bad. They will be hard-headed and never give in to others. They will be constant liars and troublemakers, and they will think nothing of immorality. They will be rough and cruel, sneer at those who try to be good." Verse 4, "They will betray their friends. They will be hot-headed, puffed up with pride, and prefer good times to worshiping God." Verse 5, "They may go to church, but they won't really believe anything they hear." And then he ends this section by saying to Timothy, don't be taken in by people like that. The church has to make sure that it is understanding what's going on in the world, but not being sucked in by it. It's very hard sometimes to stay neutral, especially, and I say this for myself, I believe that I am an Israelite and that Israel is my brother. So it's very hard for me sometimes to sit back and watch what's happening. But what's interesting, when you know the truth of God, you know what is going to happen. And I'm going to read about that here. Let's drop down to verse 7. People are always learning but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. How long has this world tried to solve the conflict between these two peoples? It's been going on for thousands of years. And they have never, they've tried. Jimmy Carter believed he could do it when he pulled them together. Ronald Reagan did his part. Barack Obama did his part. I'm sure Donald Trump will do his part. There have been so many. The United Nations was built to try and solve this. They're always trying to learn, but they're never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Why not? Because the only truth that will end the conflict is stopping it all and trusting in God, and nobody's willing to do that. Verse 8, now as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, disapproving concerning the faith, they will progress no further, for their folly will be made manifest, as theirs also was. There's coming a time when all of this is going to come to a head. So what's coming next? As we read through this and be turning back to Leviticus chapter 26, as we read through Leviticus 26, and I'll just cover bits and pieces of this whole chapter. It's 46 verses long. Very interesting one to read again. I sometimes do this. If you are lacking something to read, just sit down and read Leviticus 26 one of these days. I also would ask you, instead of just thinking about this from the time of Moses and Aaron, think about this for modern Israel, including the United States and Britain and the Commonwealth, which we also believe to be a part of Israel. But the nation of Israel, the Jewish people themselves, as well as the United States and Britain. What would happen if they would trust God? 26, verse 1. Let's read through a few things here. Don't make idols for yourselves. Don't set up carved images or sacred pillars. Don't set up an engraved stone in the land. Don't bow down to them, for I am the Lord your God. Keep my Sabbaths, reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, what will he do for the nation of Judah if they'll just stop and trust him? What will they do for the United States if we'll just stop and trust him? I will give you rain in its season, verse 4. The land will yield its produce. The trees of the field will yield their fruit. Your threshing will last until vintage, and vintage will last until sowing. You'll have bread to the full. You will dwell in your land safely. Verse 6, I will give peace in the land, and you will lie down, and none will make you afraid. That is something I'm promising you is not happening right now in the nation of Israel. They are not going to bed in peace. They're going to bed not knowing whether a bomb's going to go off in their house tomorrow. I will rid the land of evil beasts, and the sword will not go through your land. Verse 7, you will chase your enemies, and they will fall by the sword before you. 5 will chase 100, and 100 will put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies will fall by the sword before you. And you can go on and read this entire section of what it is that that God is trying to tell the people of the area that will happen to them. Now, I want to pause for a minute. I want to come back, and I'm going to talk about what happens if they don't obey God. But I want to go back a little bit in the story. We read in 1 Timothy about that perilous times were going to come. I'd like for you to consider something. Go to Matthew 24. We'll return here in just a moment. But go to Matthew 24. And I just wanted to generally summarize from verse 3 through verse 14. This is Jesus Christ answering the question from his disciples. When's the end of the age going to come and when are you going to come back? The first part, from verse 3 to verse 14, is Jesus Christ saying, after I die, here's what's going to happen to you, kind of from the time I die up until toward the time of the end. And it gives just some general prophecies about wars and things going on and famines and pestilence and all that. But he gets down to verse 15, and it gets specific when he talks about what will happen at the time of the end. I want to read from verse 15 to verse 22. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel standing in the holy place, where's the holy place? Well, most people would say that this is probably talking about somewhere in the Middle East, in the area surrounding or in Jerusalem itself. Whoever reads him, let him understand. Those that are in Judea, get out. There will be people that will be there that will have to leave. Let him who's on the housetop not go down and take out anything from the house. Don't let him in the field go back to get his clothes. Woe to those that are pregnant or nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight be not in the winter or on the Sabbath. For there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days would be shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. You know, it says here that this will be a worst time that has ever happened, ever. How bad has this world gotten in the past? During the Holocaust, an estimated 11 million people died. It's going to be worse than that. The Black Death and the bubonic plague took 25 million people in 5 years. It's going to be worse than that. Human trafficking. 20 to 30 million people are in slavery today through human trafficking. It's going to be worse than that. How much worse can it get? But what he says here is unless God intervenes, the world would end up destroying itself. But for the elect's sake, because he has a plan, he's going to stop it. It won't end because people will figure out how to solve it. We're not going to have another Camp David peace accord. That's not what's going to solve the problem. It'll get solved when Jesus Christ returns. Go to verse 37. Verse 37. But as in the days of Noah, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. Verse 39, they didn't know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. It's interesting. Noah was telling them all along. He was preaching for over 100 years while he was building the ark. There's a flood coming. The Bible is resplendent with prophecies about there is a great tribulation coming. But everyone seems to be asleep. For the sake of time, I won't turn back and read it, but if you want to put it in your notes, Genesis 6, verses 5 through 7, it says that during the time of Noah, it says that everybody that was alive at the time, with the exception of, I would say, the family of Noah, their thoughts were only evil continually. It had gotten to the place where there was no value left in human life. And God said, I'm going to wipe it out. It's going to get that bad once again. Let's go back to 2 Timothy. No, sorry, I did that. Let's go back to Leviticus now. Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 26. So we read earlier from kind of the verse 1 through verse 13. I didn't read all of it, but you get the gist of it. If you obey God, if you keep his commandments, he was very specific. Keep the commandments, keep my Sabbath, let me take care of it for you. You'll chase your enemies, you'll have peace, you go to bed at night, not have to worry about it. But what happens if they don't? Let's start in verse 14. But if you won't obey me, if you won't observe my commandments, if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you don't perform my commandments, but break my covenant, I will also do this to you, nation of Israel, Jews, to you, United States and Britain, to you, the people of Israel. Notice the very first thing it says, verse 16, I will appoint terror over you. Isn't that interesting? That's 20 years ago, we didn't hear much about the word terror. But starting in 2001, that started to be a big word. God is telling people through prophecy that terror is going to happen to the people of God who don't follow God's way. I will appoint terror over you. Wasting disease and fever, which will consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart. You will sow your seed in vain, and your enemies will eat it. I will set my face against you, and you will be defeated by your enemies. Well, now, wait a minute. God said if you follow what I say in the first part of Leviticus 26, you don't even have to fight your own battles. I'll take care of this, right? Here, Israel, today, you take, 5,000 people, and you go to this town, and I'll give it to you. And they would do that and they would win the wars, wouldn't lose anybody. But when they don't follow God, things start to happen. He will appoint terror. It says that there would be sorrow of heart. And that's happening today. The world right now is sick with fear. It's very hard to pin down a problem. Great nations seem to be at a loss on how to stop terrorism. Have you ever noticed that? We've got the best army in the world. We've got great battleships. We got nuclear weapons. And yet, who are we fighting? Have you ever thought about that? When it's terror, who are you fighting? Look at verse 17. I will set my face against you, and you will be defeated by your enemies. Right? That almost sounds like this massive army is going to come in. But notice what it says right after this. And those who hate you will reign over you, and you will flee when no one pursues you. Who's pursuing the United States? Who's pursuing Berlin when they had a bombing recently? Who's, you know, the thing that's happening in Turkey? Who is ISIS? Who is Al-Qaeda? Are they a great nation with millions of soldiers and nuclear weapons? No, they're individuals with a backpack full of explosive. It's terror. The idea isn't to defeat anyone through an amassing army. That's almost like old school. Remember back in the when we visited Chalmette, you see these the people line up in these nice clean rows, and they kind of march toward each other, and they shoot each other, and then all of a sudden guerrilla warfare comes in, and it's like, well, that old way of lining people up, we're not going to do that anymore. We're getting killed. Right? So then you get armies with all these things, and now to fight terror, a nuclear bomb's not going to solve the problem. Right? You've just got these individual people that are going around and causing fear. These things, brethren, should not be happening to the nation of Israel, which would include the United States, which would include England. We should be blessed by God because we're observing his commandments. Instead, the nations or the peoples of Israel are in constant fear of their surrounding nations. You saw that in the video. They are daily wanting to know where the next rocket is going to come from and who's going to be killed next. When they obeyed God, those elements were kept at bay. When Israel was in the wilderness and they feared God, God was with them. But once they disobeyed, then they became the ones to experience fear. Drop down to verse 23. Here's what Israel can expect next. Verse 23, if by these things you're not reformed by me, but continue to walk contrary to me, I will walk contrary to you, and I will punish you yet seven more times for your sin. What will he do? I will bring a sword against you, and I will execute the vengeance of the covenant. When you are gathered together within your cities, I will send pestilence, and you will be delivered into the hand of your enemy. We're going to read some specific prophecies about that in just a minute. How far do I want to read here? Let's go down to verse 33. I will scatter you among the nations. I will draw out a sword after you, and your land will be desolate and your cities waste. That actually happened. The nation of Israel was taken out of their land, and then later the nation of Judah was taken out of their land. Some of them were allowed to return. You saw in this video where hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people were coming back from Europe. Why were they in Europe? They had to flee. When the Ottoman Turks came in and took over the nation, the land of Israel, and took over Jerusalem, when the Romans came and took over, the Jews were expelled, and they had to leave. Because they weren't obeying God, they had to leave. Verse 34, I always find this interesting. This is a bit of poetry. It says, then the land, after the cities are laid waste, then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate, and you are in your enemy's lands. Then the land will enjoy its rest and its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it will rest for the time that it didn't rest on your Sabbath when you dwelt there. Kind of a poetic way of saying, because you didn't do what I said, I'm going to give the land to somebody else. And guess what? That's happened over and over and over. The Jews were allowed to go in. They were removed. They were allowed to go back. They were removed. This has been a constant thing. They're back now, and they're trying to establish themselves as a nation. And as a result of that, then the Arabs that are surrounding them, the people of Canaan that are still there, are still fighting against them. I want to review now, as we start to bring this to a close, a few of the prophecies about Israel at the time of the end. Let's start in Zechariah chapter 12. We'll read several. Zechariah chapter 12. We're going to read several prophecies about what's going to happen in the land of Israel at the time of the end. These are prophecies that are yet to happen. Zechariah 12, starting verse 1. This is the burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. So this is God talking to the people of the nations, and there's more than one, the nations of Israel. Thus it says, the Eternal who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundations of the earth, and forms the spirit of man in him. He's giving them a reminder. I'm the guy that created all of this in the first place. If you would just let me do this, I would handle this. Verse 2, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples, and when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. A cup of drunkenness. If you were to visit Jerusalem today, you would see the old city divided up into four sections. The Jews have a portion. Palestinians have a section. The Christians have a section. Greek Orthodox and other areas, and it's all divided. It's supposed to be an international city of peace, and it's one of the worst places in the world for how to go about having peace. To go up on the Temple Mount, which is controlled by the Arabs, you have to go through Israeli police. You go through a metal detector to be able to get up there because they're afraid that someone's going to try and blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Dome of the Rock. They won't allow you to go up on the Temple Mount with a Bible. They'll confiscate it from you because they're afraid that you're going to go up there and start spouting off some Jewish nonsense and blah, blah, blah. And it is just a place that is on the edge, and it's on the edge all the time. I will make, verse 2, Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples. Who are the surrounding peoples? The Palestinians, the Israelis, everybody that lives there. Verse 3, it will happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all people. You know what a heavy stone is like? You ever tried to clear your land and you got this big stone and you're doing what you can to something I can never do again since I've had my hernia surgery? A heavy stone that you're trying to push around. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. Every nation of the earth, we're going to see that in just a moment, is going to get gathered against Israel and specifically against Jerusalem. Keep reading. In that day, says the Eternal, verse 4, I will strike every horse, he's talking about armed conflict, with confusion, and its rider with madness. So even though armies are going to come against it, they're going to not be able to take over the land of Jerusalem. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah, and I will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. The governors of Judah will say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength and the Lord of hosts, their God. In that day, I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the woodpile and like a fiery torch in the sheaves, and they will devour all of the surrounding peoples on the right hand and on the left. But Jerusalem will be inhabited again in her own place, Jerusalem. Verse 7, the Eternal will save the tents of Judah first. So God's going to intervene to make sure that it doesn't get completely run over, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem will not become greater than that of Judah. In that day, the Eternal will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who is feeble among them in the day will be like David, and the house of David will be like God, and the angel of the Lord before them. It shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all of the nations that come against Jerusalem. There is going to come a time, and again, we'll read about it in just a moment, where all of the nations of the world are going to end up in the land of Judah. And right before the return of Jesus Christ, this is going to be the center of the hotbed. It calls it a fire pan that you set in the fire. It's just going to ignite into a conflagration. That's what we have coming up next. Go to Revelation chapter 16, and let's read about that. Revelation chapter 16, and let's start in verse 12. Revelation 16, verse 12. Then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates. Again, I wish I had a map up here. I should have done that. If you could see where the Euphrates is, it's a river that separates Israel and Syria and Lebanon and all of that from the hordes which are just on the other side of it, which would be Iraq, Iran, the areas up by the Baltic Sea. I will pour out this bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water will be dried up so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. So armies from the east. We already saw earlier, if you again go back and listen to King of the North and King of the South, that there would be armies from the south, the Arabic nations. Armies from the north, from Europe, will be coming. Now we have armies from the east. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophets. For they are spirits of demons performing signs, which will go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world, and they will gather them together of that great day of God Almighty. And where will they be gathered? Verse 15, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches, that's you and me, brethren, and keeps his garments, lest he be naked and they see his shame. And they gathered them together in the place in Hebrew called Har Megiddon, the hill of Megiddo. If you ever see the hill of Megiddo, I've been there. You stand up on the hill. It was an old city that's just a pile of ruins now. But you look over this yawning valley, and all these nations of the world are going to be standing in this place for this final battle. Isaiah chapter 11. This is the good news, which shows that God is going to protect this land so that it won't be completely run over. Isaiah chapter 11, I want to start reading in verse 11. Isaiah 11 and verse 11. And that's not it. I'm in Isaiah 1. Isaiah 11. I knew something was wrong. My Bible should know where I want to go. Isaiah 11, verse 11. It will come to pass in that day that the Lord will set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left, whether they're in Assyria or Egypt or Pathros or Cush, that's in places in Egypt, Elam and Shinar and Hamath, or in the islands of the sea, talking about British Commonwealth. Verse 12, he will set up a banner for the nations, and he will assemble the outcasts of Israel, and he will gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Even also the envy of Ephraim will depart. The adversaries of Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not envy Judah. Judah will not harass Ephraim. But they will fly down upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. And they will plunder the people of the east. And they will lay their hand on Edom and Moab. And the people of Ammon will obey them. And the Eternal will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt. With his mighty wind he will shake his fist over the river and strike it in the seven streams, and men will cross over dry shod. And there will be a highway for the remnant of his people who will be left from Assyria, as it was for Israel in the day that he came up from the land of Egypt. So there is a time coming when God's going to restore all of Israel back to their land. Again, I won't read it for the sake of time, but Isaiah chapter 51 is a really good chapter that details this entire process, where it talks about, you know, there are people that are coming up against you, but if you just let me take care of this, I will wipe them out, and you will be able to return to your land. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 36 for a last kind of look at prophecy here. Ezekiel chapter 36. And we'll start in verse 24. Similar promise. I will take you from among the nations. I will gather you out of all the countries, and I will bring you into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. And I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and all your idols. I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. This is talking about a time after Jesus Christ returns, when the nation of Israel will be established again. And this time, they'll do it the way God wants. Verse 27, I will put my spirit within you, and I will cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them. And then you will dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, and you will be my people, and I will be your God. And he goes through and he talks through this entire section here. If you do this, and if you allow this, and obviously this will happen at this time because people will have the Holy Spirit of God, then there will be no enemies that will be able to take them over again. Starting in verse 33, I won't read that all the way through. It talks about that the land will become like the Garden of Eden again, and that nobody will be able to come back and bespoil it, because Israel will be restored to its greatness, and the people of God will again become the people of God. So how should we see this, brethren? Let's bring this to a close. We've just got a couple of scriptures left. Let's go back to 2 Timothy chapter 3, where we started. 2 Timothy chapter 3, we had a section where we talked about perilous times would come. But toward the end of 2 Timothy 3, there's a message to the people of God. So in verse 1 through 9, he talked about all of the calamities that were going to happen to the nation of Israel and to the people that didn't follow God. But notice verse 10, and this is a message for all of you sitting in this room right now. But you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, and perseverance. Persecutions, yep. Afflictions, yep. They've happened, and they will continue to happen. Verse 12, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will, from time to time, have to suffer persecution. But evil men and imposters will continue to grow worse, deceiving and being deceived. Verse 14, but you must continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you have learned them, that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation. Verse 16, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. It is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness. Why? Verse 17, that the man of God may be complete and thoroughly equipped to every good work. These are the traits, brethren, of the people of God. In an age that doesn't fear God, in an age where there will be conflicts, and we're going to see the conflicts continue to rise, the people of God need to be set in their ways to where they know that if we trust God, even though we will suffer persecution from time to time, if we trust God and we let Him fight the battles for us, we're going to be all right. Finally, let's go to Revelation chapter 22. Revelation chapter 22 and start in verse 6. Then he said to me, these words are faithful and true, and the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angels to show his servants the things which must shortly come to pass. Brethren, we have prophecies that are given to us so that we know ahead of time what's going to happen. You see all these conflicts and you see how they're not able to solve it, but yet we know the solution is coming. Verse 7, behold, I am coming quickly. Blessed are those who keep the words of the book of this prophecy. Drop down to verse 12. Behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me, to give to everyone according to his work. I am the beginning and the end, the Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last. What's he saying there? You know, you may be looking at this crisis that's happening right now, but I've been there from the start. I'm the one that created it in the first place. I know what's happened in the past. I know what's going to happen in the future. I got this. Trust me. That's what he's saying. I got this. Verse 14, blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life. That's on the other side of the great conflicts that are coming. And that they may enter through the gates into the city. Verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things in the churches. In other words, he wants this preached. There are some tough times coming, but I'm telling you, if you trust me, I'll take care of this. And this is to be read in all the churches. I am the root, the offspring of David, the bright morning star. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. Let him who thirsts come. For whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. When Jesus Christ set the Bible in record, he put in there enough information for us to be able to look at and to be able to watch what's happening. So tonight at midnight, we start 2017. What's going to happen to the United States? What's going to happen to the Middle East? What's going to happen to Jerusalem? What's going to happen to Turkey? What's going to happen as a result of the Russian prime minister being shot? What's going to happen with this UN resolution? While we don't know all of the specifics of what will happen, we do know what to watch for. We've been given enough warning about what's going on. I remember back to, and I actually tried to find it and I couldn't, but Mr. Armstrong used to say back in the 50s and 60s when we were first coming to church, watch the Middle East. That was a big deal to him because he knew that ultimately it wasn't going to be Russia that attacked the United States. It was going to be somewhere in the Middle East where the final conflagration would start. As times continue to worsen, we need to look to God and to his power and recognize that it's all a part of his plan. I want to end by rereading verse 6 and 7. These words are faithful and true. The Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants things which must shortly take place. We will know before it happens. Behold, I am coming quickly. Blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book. That's a command to us that we should be continuing to study prophecy, because as it happens, as it starts to unfold, it will become apparent. Things jump out at you when you listen to the news, when you're reading prophecy and you understand, you see it. The rest of the world isn't really caring about this Israeli mandate by the UN. It's not that big a deal. They're more into the Russian hacking thing and all of that right now. That's just noise on the floor. There are issues out there that are really important, and we need to be watching them. So, again, sorry this was a longer sermon than normal, but I hope that it was useful for you. And keep your eyes peeled, and we'll see what happens for 2017 as the plan of God will continue to unfold, and we will see it come to its rightful conclusion, hopefully in our lifetimes.